You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, it's the Friday News Roundup. This week on the Roundup, the president makes a secret trip to Kyiv. There's news from Ohio, the U.S. Supreme Court, and even Grey's Anatomy, as viewers say goodbye to one of TV's longest-running characters. That's all coming up on the Friday News Roundup today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, 1 year since Russia launched its widespread invasion of Ukraine and started a wider war that is still going on today, Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke at the United Nations calling for continued global support for Ukraine. President Biden spoke in Warsaw, Poland after a surprise visit to Ukraine's capital.
A dictator bent on rebuilding an empire will never be able to ease the people's love of liberty. Brutality will never grind down the will of the free. And Ukraine will never be a victory for Russia. Never.
The White House today announced the U.S. will impose a new round of sanctions on Russians and supporters in other countries. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on the war at this point, 1 year after Russia invaded the whole of Ukraine? What questions do you have about how it's going? What's happened? What could happen next? Do you support continued support for Ukraine from the United States? What more, if anything, do you think Americans can or should be doing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Tom Nichols is a writer at The Atlantic. He's the author of a number of books, including No Use, Nuclear Weapons and U.S. National Security. He spent 25 years as a professor of national security affairs at the United States Naval War College, began his career as an expert in Soviet and Russian affairs. Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
You wrote a new piece for The Atlantic in the Daily Newsletter, not on the particulars of the fighting, but kind of a sense of what we've lost, the changing of an era and the hope you had after the fall of the Soviet Union. Can you share some of your reflections?
Sure. I think a lot of us who lived through that period as adults, I was 31 when the Soviet Union collapsed, and I had been to the Soviet Union multiple times before 1991. I think we had a real jolt of optimism to say, you know, the Cold War, this 15-year confrontation is over. That doesn't mean all our problems are over. It doesn't mean we've solved, you know, all of the trouble in the world. But I think it was a moment where we said, you know, we can start finding better ways to do things. We can start getting rid of nuclear weapons, which we remarkably have managed to get rid of a lot of them. We can cooperate on major problems. We can really cement the rules of the international system about not changing borders by force and, seeking diplomacy first and so on. And I think that the war in Ukraine, and I would remind people, this is the biggest war in Europe since the Nazis launched their campaign in 1939, really put an end to all of that. That we really are kind of having to plant the flag and stand in defense of freedom and democracy and a rules-based international order with something like an understanding that, you know, sovereign nations have the right to be free. And I just find that profoundly depressing because for 30 years, I had really hoped that we would find a different way.
It seemed like we had turned a corner from so much of history where I think there was a presumption that, hey, if my country's army is bigger than yours, we can redraw the map with that army, whether that's a next door neighbor or a colony. We had a pretty good run of not many of those kind of wars. Do you worry that this could open the door to that kind of thinking again?
Well, I worry that it'll open the door to that kind of thinking if the Russians win. Interestingly enough, one of the people who for years said that we shouldn't live in that kind of world where it shouldn't just be a matter of who has a bigger army, and that you shouldn't just erase other countries off the map was a guy named Vladimir Putin, who used to say all of the right things for the first 10 or 15 years that he was in power. And now I think he's an old man. He's decided that this is his legacy, that he's going to reconstruct some kind of empire in Europe. But yeah, we did have a good run with that for a long time. And I think, again, that's one of the things that's been unfortunately, it's been lost, at least for now. But I think the outcome isn't over yet, and a lot will depend on whether the Russians win or lose in this war.
Turning to the war in particular, there were, I think, hopes at various points that the war would be over quickly, either from Putin and his supporters that Ukraine would fall within weeks. I think there were bursts of optimism in the West that Ukraine might roll Russian troops out of their country quickly. It doesn't seem like, Tom, anything is going to conclusively end. I don't know, anytime soon. What are you looking at?
Yeah, not anytime soon. And, you know, I was one of those people early on where I thought, well, this will, you know, the Russians are three times the size of Ukraine. They're attacking from three different directions along eight or nine strategic axes of advance. And, you know, this will be over pretty soon, unfortunately. But, you know, I think a lot of us underestimated the Ukrainians and way overestimated the Russians. And so I think none of those conditions have changed. The Ukrainians keep getting better and better, and the Russians are getting worse, in part because many of their best troops, some of their best forces, some of their best units, they just burned them in the first 3 months of the war. And now they're throwing literally, they refer to them, the expression here in English, of course, we talk about cannon fodder. In Russia, they refer to these new draftees as cannon meat. And they're just throwing these boys and men into a meat grinder, hoping to wear down the Ukrainians. So, yeah, this isn't going to end, you know, tomorrow. That's for sure.
Talking to Tom Nichols, he writes at The Atlantic, a longtime history as an expert in Soviet and Russian affairs. Looking at the one-year anniversary of the large-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine, you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. Let's bring on a caller now. Giuseppe joins us in Kenosha. Giuseppe, hi.
Hi. Thanks. Thank you for taking my call.
What did you want to bring up?
Well, you were saying, what else can the United States do to help Ukraine? And to me, the problem lies with countries like Italy. I'm Italian myself, so that do not take a stronger position like England or Germany. You know, Italy's always had some kind of business with financial business with Russia, and one of the prime ministers in Italy also had a closer connection with Putin. So they're dragging their feet in being more assertive. And I think it's important that, like the gentleman before said, that they have a lot of men in Russia. They keep throwing men there. So, and if countries like Italy and Hungary don't stand stronger, then there's a risk that the coalition weakens. And that's what Putin wants. He wants, you know, like somebody that weakens the wall that's been built.
Giuseppe, thanks a lot for the call. Giuseppe worried about some NATO partners, including Hungary and Italy. Italy, where the prime minister is showing support, but Silvio Berlusconi, coalition member, former prime minister, very close with Putin, very critical of Ukraine and Zelensky. Tom, and it seems like one of Putin's main hopes is that exactly what Giuseppe is worried about happens, that the coalition doesn't hold together in supporting Ukraine.
Yeah, I think Putin counted on that early on to say, you know, NATO, you know, everyone will be outraged for a few weeks and then it'll all die down and we'll all go back to business as usual while Russia absorbs and loots Ukraine. That didn't happen. And I think what's really one of the things I find remarkable after a year of war is how united NATO is at this point. In fact, I think that unity has actually been growing, rather than declining, in part due to the actions of the Russians themselves. That, you know, Putin has no interest in negotiations, and he is, you know, the vice president made the point the other day, these are crimes against humanity. This isn't just a war. I mean, there are crimes against humanity, war crimes underway, including things like kidnapping children and taking them to Russia, targeting civilians intentionally. And so I think if Putin was counting on this, he has to be disappointed. And I think it was really a turning point, a watershed moment when President Biden went to Kiev and walked the streets of the Ukrainian capital with Zelensky. Because that that really was a commitment on the part of the Americans to say, we're in this, we're not going anywhere. You know, a year later, we're not getting tired of, you know, hearing about this war, and we're going to be with you for as long as it takes. And I think in some ways, Putin has only himself to blame for that, because once the war went badly, he just couldn't reassess. I mean, his whole strategy has just been to get a bigger hammer and kill more people. And, you know, I truthfully never thought I would be sitting here thinking about Finland and Sweden being in a NATO, you know, that would be 32 countries. But the Russians have managed to make that a possibility.
Thanks for the call, Giuseppe. We're talking to Tom Nichols, staff writer at The Atlantic, looking at the first anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest, a longtime observer of the Soviet Union and then of Russia? How do you think the war could or should end? What role do you want to see the U.S. play? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Tom Nichols, Russia expert and staff writer at The Atlantic, looking at the war in Ukraine 1 year to the day after Russia launched its large-scale invasion of the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Mark is with us in New Berlin. Mark, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I think that we're really slowballing the arms and munitions that they need. It's pathetic, really, that we can't give them tanks immediately, that they couldn't have the MiG fighters that were in Poland that were left over there, that they would have at least had those jet planes and more equipment that we have available. It was President Clinton, unless I'm wrong, that promised that we would defend the Ukraine if they would give up their nuclear weapons. They'd have nothing to worry about. We would protect them. And we've got a weak president. He's not doing it.
Mark, thanks for the call. Two main points there. Tom, first of all, Mark says we're not getting arms and ammunition to Ukraine fast enough.
Yeah, I think Mark's absolutely right. The United States and other countries are big, clumsy bureaucracies that really weren't meant to do what they're trying to do now, which is to move arms to a non-allied but friendly country. And, you know, I wish that we were doing it more quickly as well. I mean, I think some of this is just bureaucracy and just the sluggishness of large organizations trying to move things around. On the other hand, there were people who were certain that we weren't going to be able to get weapons to the Ukrainians in time for them to survive the winter, that, come the first snowfalls in November or December, that, you know, this whole thing was going to go down the tubes for the Ukrainians. And that hasn't happened. We've gotten them long-range artillery and a lot of other weapons. And I think you're going to see that improve. But as a general point, absolutely agree with your caller that we should be doing this faster and more effectively.
Mark, thanks for the call. Mark also mentioning past commitments, Ukraine giving up the nuclear weapons that was on its soil. Does Mark have the history there about right?
Yeah, no, this is, I was happy to agree with Mark a moment ago, but I have to correct him on some of the history here. What he's thinking of is the Budapest Memorandum of 1994. And that was a joint declaration by the United States, Great Britain, and Russia, but Russia at that point was under President Boris Yeltsin, who was a much more Western-facing leader than Putin is. And it said that all of these countries resolved to respect the sovereignty of Ukraine. The problem was that the Ukrainians keeping their nuclear weapons was never a realistic option. Most of those weapons that were based in Ukraine were actually strategic weapons that were aimed at us. And I actually think, and I've written about this, if people want to find it on the internet, I've written pieces where I think had the Ukrainians kept their nuclear weapons, the Russians probably would have invaded them a lot sooner, perhaps 10 or 15 years ago, on the pretense that Ukraine back then, still pretty unstable in its politics, that they would have said, we just can't have an unstable country, you know, with loose nuclear weapons in them. And I think that actually would have been more dangerous. But because, again, especially because a lot of those weapons were not tactical level nuclear weapons, but the long range weapons that are aimed at the United States. So I still think getting rid of those weapons was the right thing for the Ukrainians to do. I don't think anybody would want to see a nuclear war being fought in Central Europe. And the Russian government that signed off on that was Yeltsin's government, unfortunately. By the way, the Budapest Memorandum, the one requirement is that if there's a problem, this one of the signatories has to take it to the UN Security Council. It's not a treaty of defense or alliance where it's, you know, you're going to defend them militarily. And of course, we did that. We went to the UN Security Council. The big problem right now is that the UN Security Council has Russia sitting on it, a country that's basically acting like a nuclear armed rogue state. So, you know, the United Nations is kind of out of play right now. But that's what that memorandum was about.
Let's go back to our callers. Mike is with us in St. Lawrence. Mike, hello.
Hi. Just a quick comment. I'm not a very good historian, but I just want to say, in shock and awe was the theme for the Iraq invasion, based on a false premise of weapons of mass destruction, which reminded me of the false premise of going into Vietnam. Both involved the United States invading another country, basically for supposedly the stop of communism, and then supposedly to corral weapons of mass destruction. I don't agree with what Putin is doing, but it's the same kind of power grab that the United States has done over the years. And I just wish the Ukrainian people the best, that I hope this comes to a peaceful resolution. I agree with your guest.
Mike, thanks for the call. Tom, do you agree with the parallels Mike is drawing there?
Yeah, I don't. I think, you know, with Vietnam, it's easy to forget now that we actually had a treaty of alliance with the Vietnamese. And had we not come to their aid, and, you know, we can debate the wisdom of whether that was the right thing to do or not, but South Vietnam probably would have fallen sometime in 1965 or 66. And there, you can actually listen to LBJ on recordings talking to other members of the government and Congress saying, you know, what, I don't want to go into Vietnam. What am I supposed to do here? We didn't take over Iraq and try to absorb it as, you know, the 51st state. I think what people really need to understand is Putin has said, and he has said for years, Ukraine doesn't exist. It's not a place. It's not actually a country. What Putin's doing is the equivalent of what Saddam Hussein did in 1991 when he said, Kuwait is not a country. It's the 19th province of Iraq. And I think the question that people need to wrestle with is, do you want to live in a world where a large nuclear-armed power can simply reach out and say, you don't exist anymore as a country. We are your new government, and, you know, we will occupy you and take what you have and plant our flag there, and, you cease to exist. You're now part of Russia. I suppose the equivalent would be if the United States had invaded Canada or Mexico and said, that's it. We've annexed them. They're ours. There is no Mexico. There is no Canada. They're just, you know, American territory now, because that's what Putin did. So, I mean, that's not to excuse or whitewash a lot of, you know, stupid and aggressive things that the United States has done in its history. But I think to understand what Putin did, you really have to understand that this was crossing an international border and literally trying to wipe another country out of existence by just taking it over. And I think if you're thinking about historical parallels, the invasion of South Korea, the invasion of the Falkland Islands, the invasion of Kuwait by Iraq, those are actually the parallels.
Thanks for that call. We heard from Kurt in Brookfield, who couldn't stay on the line and is asking, what is the final outcome Putin wants? And I think, Tom, a lot of people are puzzling over that question. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, it's a great question, because what Putin wanted was a quick collapse, Zelensky to either be dead or flee the country, and pro-Russian elements in Kiev saying, thank you for liberating us, you know, right? We'll be great. This is one place where there's a good parallel, where just like the Americans, you know, in Iraq, Putin said, we'll be greeted as liberators. I'll be throwing flowers in the streets. And he thought that was going to happen and that the Russian Federation would include this gigantic piece of territory and 40 million more people that we once called Ukraine that he would now call, you know, Little Russia. What he wants now, who knows? I think he has placed himself in a trap. He's painted himself into a corner that he can't get out of. And so, again, as I said earlier, his only answer is to get a bigger hammer and murder more people until what I think he hopes happens is that literally NATO gets tired of this. The West gets tired of it. The European Union gets tired of it. Zelensky is, you know, somehow booted out of office and the Russians are finally welcomed in. I think Putin cannot admit a mistake. People need to understand Putin is a very vain and emotional man. He is not going to admit a mistake here, because the other problem is that if he admits this mistake, he could be deposed internally in Russia at some point. And so I think what he's going to do is just keep killing people in the vain hope that the original plan somehow magically comes about, that Ukraine becomes part of Russia, which is just never going to happen.
Tom, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Tom Nichols is a staff writer at The Atlantic. We talked to him today on what he calls a grim anniversary, 1 year since Russian forces directed by President Putin invaded Ukraine. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, a new report finds big problems and challenges when it comes to the mental and emotional well-being of teenage girls in the United States. We'll look at the problem, the findings of that report, and at some possible solutions as well. And there's a lot of great stuff to do here in Wisconsin, some well-known, some off the beaten path. We're going to get some inspiration with the author of the new book, 100 Things to Do in Wisconsin Before You Die. And I hope you'll share some of your favorites as well. That's all Monday here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's Food Friday. Today's guest is a Wisconsin-based cook who brings us the flavors of India built around six spices. First, Governor Evers called for changes to the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Program in his executive budget proposal aimed at removing some hurdles for conservation projects. The changes would include a requirement that lawmaker objections to these conservation projects be made public instead of anonymous, along with relaxed rules for legislative review. The proposals come about a month after the Legislative Finance Committee blocked what might have been one of the largest conservation projects in state history. We're talking about the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Program and the governor's push to make it easier for those projects to happen. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on conservation projects in the state for this stewardship program? Should they require approval from state lawmakers? Do you have some of these in your community? Are you in a place where you think you might have too many of them in your community? There are some concerns in parts of the state. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Charles Carlin is Director of Strategic Initiatives at Gathering Waters, Wisconsin's Alliance for Land Trusts. Charlie, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. It's good to be here today.
Can you give us the basics on how the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Program Fund actually works?
So the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Program is Wisconsin's flagship environmental conservation program. And I think the most simple way to describe it is if there's a place outside in Wisconsin that you love, there's a good chance that the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Program has helped protect it, improve it, and make it accessible to you. So since 1990, the stewardship program has provided grants both to the DNR, to local governments, and to nonprofit conservation organizations to acquire land for conservation. And then it also provides grants to nonprofits and local governments and money to the DNR for the infrastructure that we need to be able to get out and enjoy all the places that make Wisconsin special. So that's things like trails, boat launches, campgrounds, even simple things like restroom facilities at state parks can be funded through the stewardship program. So it's really done tremendous work. We like to say that more than 90% of Wisconsinites live within a mile of a Knowles-Nelson stewardship project.
Looking at the proposed changes in Governor Evers' budget, now this would all have to be approved by the legislature, which is never a sure thing. He would want to allow more projects to be allowed to happen without legislative approval, essentially, as I understand it, changing the dollar threshold that requires lawmakers to weigh in. What are you seeing there? How would that work?
So the way that the program currently works is any grant for more than $250,000 or pretty arbitrarily any project in northern Wisconsin that's north of Highway 64 goes to the legislature's powerful Joint Finance Committee for review. And that committee has 2 weeks to review projects. They can ask questions, and they can do nothing, and that approves the project, or they can raise an objection, and that effectively stops the project in its tracks. And so what Governor Evers is proposing is to raise that dollar amount up to $500,000, and also to require legislators to name themselves if they want to object to a project. By current practice, legislators can object anonymously. We don't know who objects to a project. We don't know why they object to a project. And even though state law is crystal clear that the Finance Committee is expected to hold hearings to discuss those grants, that rarely ever happens. And unfortunately, the legislature has really just increasingly weaponized this ability to object to projects. I was just looking back through data from the Department of Natural Resources, and since 2014, 43 projects have been held up because of objections from the Finance Committee, and only 14 of those projects ever received a hearing.
Let's bring on a caller now. Matt is with us in Chippewa County. Matt, hi.
Hi, I'm a County Forest Administrator for Chippewa County, and it's really important for Knowles Nelson to support the counties when we are looking at land purchases. And the fact that we don't know who's objecting to our proposals is makes it very difficult to make the project successful. So I fully support the governor's changes.
Matt, thanks for the call. Charlie, what do you think?
Well, I can certainly sympathize with what Matt is saying. When an objection comes up anonymously and there are no public hearings, we don't understand what the objections are, and there's no mechanism to have a public debate so that concerns can be raised, a compromise can be reached. Instead, we're left with essentially rumor and innuendo from the legislature, and then misinformation can start to spread. You mentioned briefly at the start of this segment that the legislature has currently blocked the Pelican River State Forest in northern Wisconsin. And that's a private land conservation project. The land would be protected with a conservation easement. Right now, there's a major misinformation campaign that is spreading essentially lies about the project, saying that it's a public land acquisition, that it would take land off of the tax rolls. And because we don't have any public hearings about this, it makes it really difficult to set the record straight. And so simply having that debate would get us so much further along to being able to understand, are there legitimate concerns about projects? Can those concerns be met? And can we find some common sense compromises to help us all move forward?
Thanks for that call, Matt. We're talking to Charlie Carlin, Director of Strategic Initiatives at Gathering Waters Alliance for Land Trusts. Next up, we'll hear about what happens when the legislature doesn't support a big conservation project. Charlie stays with us. We'll hear from our own Danielle Kading, who's been following these issues. You can join in with your thoughts or questions, maybe a local experience, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation about the governor's proposed changes to the Knowles Nelson Stewardship Program, spurred in part by lawmakers' rejection of what would have been the biggest conservation project in Wisconsin, the Pelican River Forest Project. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Charlie Carlin stays with us from Gathering Waters. And Danielle Kading joins us now, reporter for WPR, covering the environment in northern Wisconsin. She wrote about the Pelican River Forest Project and the latest Natural Resources Board meeting. Danny, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
Just a few moments back, Charlie referenced that Pelican River Forest Project. Can you tell us a little more about what was going to happen and what did end up happening?
Yeah, so this was a project that would basically preserve 70,000 acres of private forest land across northern Wisconsin, and it would set it aside for recreational use and logging. And basically last fall, the Wisconsin Natural Resources Board signed off on a $15.5 million conservation easement to preserve the bulk of that project. And it would be funded in part by a federal forest legacy grant. And the state would also have to chip in some funding through the Knowles Nelson Stewardship Program in the amount of about $4 million. And this is a property that has 68 miles of streams and 27,000 acres of forested wetlands. And it's just a good link between the Oneida County Forest and the Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest. And they say it would also support hundreds of forest-related jobs as well. And so the people and the Natural Resources Board that support this project really want to see it happen for those reasons.
But it sounds like this one was blocked in this process in the legislature.
Yes, there were some lawmakers on the state's finance committee that objected to this conservation effort. So far, Senator Mary Felskowski, a Republican from Irma, is the only one who has spoken publicly about her concerns related to this. She said that there were other members of the Joint Committee on Finance who were also opposed to the project, but she declined to name them. And basically, she said that she's not opposed to stewardship funding or the state owning public land, but basically, there is already a lot of public land in northern Wisconsin counties, and there's some concerns about taking properties off the tax rolls or taking it away from the private sector. You know, she would like to see some of these lands used for either development or, you know, related to housing needs in the area. And while this project does not take lands off the tax rolls, Felskowski argues that they would be taxed at a lower rate because they're enrolled in the state's managed forest law program.
So for supporters of this project, Danny, is this done? Are they looking for alternate sources of funding, trying to bring this back to get a hearing? Where are they now on the project?
I don't think anyone wants to see this project abandoned. Right now, about $3 million in stewardship funds have been obligated for this project. If that doesn't happen by June 30th, it could get rolled over into the next year. And if the committee ultimately denies funding or fails to act, the agency might have to launch a fundraising campaign or seek a landowner donation to come up with funds to match the federal grant that they have that's paid for the bulk of this conservation easement.
Before I let you go, Danny, you've covered a related issue. Someone on the Natural Resources Board expressing concerns that the DNR isn't to funding maintenance enough of existing habitats that are protected in conservation programs. So what are the concerns there?
Yeah, board member Greg Kazmierski spoke about this at this past week's meeting. He's concerned there's not enough funding to manage habitats for wildlife as the state has added more properties under the Knowles Nelson Stewardship Program. And he's concerned that if we don't set some more money aside for this, that basically we're going to have a quote unquote wildlife desert out there if we don't keep up with that. And the DNR has said that basically a certain pot of funding for habitat management has increased over the last decade by about $4 million. And so the costs are increasing. And so the question is, how do you support that or maintain these habitats without additional funding? And they want to see some potential support from the legislature around that.
Danny, thanks a lot for bringing this to our attention.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Danielle Kading, WPR reporter, talking to us about the blocked Pelican River Forest Project and the latest Natural Resources Board meeting. Now back to Charlie Carlin with Gathering Waters, looking at the Knowles Nelson Stewardship Program. With that big project, Charlie, that you had mentioned, that Danny told us about, the Pelican River Forest Project, what are your hopes now that, at least for now, that Knowles Nelson funding has been blocked?
Well, the Knowles Nelson funding has been blocked, but I'm confident that the conservation project itself is going to move forwards. As Danny mentioned, there's $11 million in federal funding on the table from the Forest Legacy Program. And the first part of the Pelican River Forest, about 12,000 acres, has already been conserved with Knowles Nelson stewardship dollars. Interestingly, neither Senator Felskowski nor any of her colleagues on the Finance Committee raised any concerns with the first phase of that project. What might be lost if the Knowles Nelson stewardship dollars don't come through is really the enhanced public access that state support can provide. So right now, as the plan stands, there would be 70 miles of interior roads that would be opened up and maintained for public access. And the current landowner, the Conservation Fund, would fund $1.5 million endowment to make sure that those roads are maintained in perpetuity. There are also plans to expand snowmobile and ATV trails on the property. And it's really the state support that makes enhanced public access like that possible. And so I think it would be a real shame to lose out on really those great benefits for the people of Wisconsin. I think whether or not the stewardship funding is there, there is so much support for the project across the state that folks will figure out how to close that gap. And we'll make sure that this land is managed for wildlife and sustainable logging, you know, into perpetuity.
Let's go back to our callers. Grace is with us in New Glarus. Grace, hello.
Hi. So what I'm wondering about is, why are these hearings on these funds apparently are not open to the public? And why are these legislators being able to hide from their responsibility to let the public know what they're doing? Don't we have sunshine laws in this state to help deal with stuff like that?
Grace, thanks for the call. Grace, referring to the ability of Joint Finance Committee members to anonymously block these proposals, Charlie, which the governor's budget proposal would. And it is like a quirk anyway in the way state government works, as I understand it, Charlie.
It's both a quirk and the Joint Finance Committee is simply not following the law as it's written. So state statute is really clear that if a member of the Finance Committee wants to object to a Knowles Nelson project, they have to notify the DNR that a meeting has been scheduled to discuss the grant. Instead, the letters that the Finance Committee sends to the DNR simply say an objection has been raised and a meeting will be scheduled. And then, of course, they very rarely hold those meetings. So it is true that within state statute, there's essentially a loophole that allows legislators to object without naming themselves. And then the failure of the Finance Committee to schedule and hold those hearings means that legislators' positions never go on the public record. Proponents of projects never have an opportunity to speak up. And because votes are rarely held on these projects, a single legislator can stall a project when really I think the intent of the law is to allow a majority of the Finance Committee to put the brakes on a project if they have some major concerns. So in effect, what we have right now is the Finance Committee not following the law. And because they're not following the law, a single legislator can exercise an anonymous pocket veto. And I really share Grace's perception there. It's outrageous. It's an affront to basic principles of good democracy. And the governor's proposals are certainly a step in the right direction.
Thanks for the call, Grace. Briefly, as we wrap up, Charlie, would you hope for a public hearing process where local concerns, local objections could be raised, negotiated around, and you know people could find compromises if they see problems with particular projects?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think the thing that we would like to see added to the governor's proposal is really clear timelines for hearings and votes. So, for example, if we said a hearing had to be held within 30 days and a vote within 60 days, and those hearings would be public, then those with concerns and those who are proponents of projects would both have an opportunity to make their voices heard. Legislators could debate the merits of a project, and they would vote on that project, and we would know where each legislator stands. And that would be a really crucial step towards bringing just some basic accountability and transparency and good governance back to the way the Finance Committee operates.
Charlie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
That's Charlie Carlin, Director of Strategic Initiatives at Gathering Waters. He talked to us about Governor Evers' proposed changes to the Knowles Nelson Stewardship Program. We also heard from WPR reporter Danielle Kading. opioid overdose deaths are increasing across Wisconsin, and the Menominee Indian tribe has the highest rate of deaths. But tribal leaders are working on new approaches to address the issue. Evan Casey reports on efforts by the tribe and its 8,500 members to curb that increase.
On the day her first son was born, Lighty Dodge's dad died of a drug overdose. Just 2 years later, her mother died from liver failure following a battle with alcoholism. Dodge was just 21 years old. She started taking prescription drugs to help deal with the grief. That quickly turned to illegal drugs.
I got really bad on heroin, and then heroin wasn't enough, so then I got really bad on fentanyl, and I got introduced to the wrong people.
Dodge is Native American and a direct descendant of the Menominee Indian Tribe of Wisconsin. She battled addiction for years while living on the tribe's Northeast Wisconsin reservation. She was in and out of drug court and treatment centers. But in 2021, she got clean. Today, she's 29 years old and 20 months sober. She says she wants to be there for her children.
Had it not been for them and my family and like the team that I had, I might not have made it, right? Like, this is my first time actually trying to get sober, right? Going to treatment, doing the things that I needed to do, and really setting, like, the foundation for my recovery to build.
Unfortunately, Dodge's story of addiction is not unique to her. National stats show Native Americans experience higher overdose death rates than other racial and ethnic groups. Overdoses among all races soared during the COVID-19 pandemic, and they haven't declined yet. Many of the deaths involve fentanyl, a drug 80 to 100 times stronger than morphine. That's something Wisconsin's Menominee Indian tribe is trying to fight. Menominee County has the highest overdose death rate in the entire state. Last year, the tribe saw a record 16 overdose deaths. On a sunny Monday in January, a group of tribal officials gathered in the reservation's community center for a meeting of its new drug intervention team.
Welcome, everybody. We're going to go ahead and get going with our drug intervention team meeting here.
Police Chief Keith Turtelot is on the team. He says the issue is so bad, his officers are getting burned out from all the calls they're going to.
It's a common situation that we go from one overdose to the next.
The chief says police regularly give out the overdose reversal medication, Narcan.
But we need to make sure that we can get to them and get them into treatment and get them help, and that's what this whole organization is about.
The team is working to coordinate efforts with law enforcement, as well as to increase prevention and treatment efforts on the reservation. They're also working to get more recovery coaches. They'll be available through a 24/7 hotline. Addie Caldwell is a member of the team and the director of the Manisakio Wellness Center. She envisions the coaches as the initial contact for someone who is seeking to get clean.
They're our first stop. They're the first person that's going to meet with someone to figure out where that person is at, what that person needs, and then kind of tailor what they are doing to fit what that person needs.
In a phone conversation, Caldwell said the issue often starts at home.
You know, we have multiple generations sometimes in one household, and if one person is struggling with addiction, that potentially is being seen by, you know, younger kids.
Today, Lighty Dodge is living in Shawano and working as a recovery coach for others who also want to get clean. She has 5 boys and a 6-month-old daughter. She says she's encouraged by the work the tribe is doing. She's now attending meetings of the intervention team.
I want to show people, right? It is possible. It's possible to do it, like, to get through probation, get through recovery, to do these things and get turn your life around and really do it, right? And not just say you're doing it.
Tribal leaders are making progress on many of the new initiatives they started to discuss last year. Just 2 weeks ago, many of the new recovery coaches met for the first time. They're hoping to make an immediate impact. Evan Casey, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. Our guest today tells us how to make healthy, fuss-free Indian dishes using 6 key spices. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.